Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo, Alice Bryant, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Rising rates of depression among American teenagers and young adults have led to a major question. Could the same devices being blamed for causing depression be used to find it? Studies have linked heavy smartphone use with worsening teen mental health. But as teens spend time on sites like Instagram, Snapchat, and YouTube, they also leave digital paths that may offer signs about their mental well-being. Experts say possible warning signs include changes in writing speed, voice quality, word choice, and how often a child stays home from school. There are more than 1,000 smartphone biomarkers, said Dr. Thomas Insel. He is former head of the National Institute of Mental Health. He has become a leader in the smartphone psychiatry movement. Researchers are testing smartphone apps that use artificial intelligence, or AI, to predict depression and possible self-harm. But there are still issues to address, including privacy issues and making sure children give permission to be closely followed. Still, app developers say that effective, widely available depression detecting apps may arrive soon. Using smartphones as mental health detectors would require permission from users to download an app. They could take back their permission at any time.
Nick Allen is a psychologist at the University of Oregon. He is one of the creators of an app being tested on young people who have attempted suicide. Allen says the biggest barrier right now is learning what the mental health crisis signals are among all of the information available on people's phones. Suicide rates have risen in recent years in the United States. Suicide is now the second leading cause of death for people between the ages of 10 and 34. By 2015, rates among teen girls rose to 5 suicides in every 100,000 people. And for boys, it is 14 in every 100,000. A recent study suggested a rise in smartphone use has probably worsened the crisis. People with mental illness, Insel said, usually get treatment when they're in crisis and very late. We want to have a method to identify the earliest signs. If smartphones can become effective predictors, app developers say the goal might be to offer automated text messages and links to assistance, or digital messages to parents, doctors, and first responders.
Facebook is already doing what it calls proactive detection. Last year, after a suicide was broadcast on Facebook Live, the company trained its AI systems to look for words in online posts that could predict possible self-harm. Friends' comments expressing concern about the user's well-being are part of that detection system. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg announced in November that the site has helped first responders quickly reach around 3,500 people in the past year. But the company did not offer details on what has happened to those people since the incidents. Ongoing research on the issue includes a Stanford University study of about 200 teens. Many of the teens are at risk for depression because of bullying, family issues, or other problems. Teens who have been studied since grade school get an experimental phone app that asks them questions about their mood 3 times a day for 2 weeks. Laurel Foster, who is 15, is one of the teens from the study. She admits she feels stress over school and teen friendship pressures. She says depression is common at her San Francisco high school. She said using the smartphone app felt a little like being spied on. But she added that so many websites are already following users' behaviors.
At the University of California, Los Angeles, researchers are offering online counseling and an experimental phone app to students who show signs of at least minor depression on a test. It is part of a larger effort launched in 2017 by the university to battle depression in its students. About 250 UCLA students agreed to use the app during their first year. Alyssa Lizarraga, who is 19, is among those being studied. She has had depression since high school. Lizarraga has worried about her heavy use of smartphones and social media. She said comparing herself with others online sometimes causes her sadness. But she believes using smartphones to identify mental health problems might help push people to seek early treatment. At the University of Illinois' Chicago campus, researchers are using crowdsourcing to test their experimental phone app. Anyone can download the free app, and nearly 2,000 have so far. All agreed to let the researchers follow things such as their typing behaviors. Dr. Alex Liao, a professor of psychiatry and bioengineering at the university, helped develop the app. The study is for people 18 and up, but Liao said it could also be used for children if successful. Along with studies at universities, technology companies such as Mindstrong and Verily, the tech health division of Google, are testing their own experimental apps. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Parts of the South in the United States are known for a kind of country music called bluegrass. And there is one instrument that is an important part of the bluegrass sound. The banjo is a truly American instrument. It was brought to the United States by African slaves, and then was adopted by people of the South to create their country music.
Really, the banjo is the American instrument, and it was made by both black and white cultures came together to produce this instrument.
That is Christian Stanfield. He and his teacher, Tom George, have made the complex art of banjo making their lifetime project. It began decades ago when Stanfield moved from Washington, D.C. to Memphis, Tennessee. He went to a dance party that featured folk music and the banjo. He says as soon as he heard the banjo, he fell in love. He borrowed one from a banjo player and got some good advice on where to buy one.
I fell in love with the banjo. I really wanted to learn that new instrument. So I borrowed a banjo from him for 2 or 3 months. And when I was ready to get a banjo of my own, he recommended Tommy to me. He said, you know, don't buy a banjo on the internet or in a store. There's a guy in Fayette County who builds them.
That man was Tom George, one of the best banjo makers in the U.S.
I just like to make things, and woodworking, banjos, furniture, whatever.
Tom George knows a true banjo lover when he sees one. So when Stanfield asked to become his student, George quickly agreed. He taught Stanfield his banjo-making secrets. After dinner, of course.
The guy would come over, and his wife would cook dinner, and we would eat dinner, and then we would go out in the shop and work for a couple of hours. And in 3 months, I had a banjo that I had made myself.
Tom George, however, did not have a teacher. He taught himself how to build banjos.
I wanted a banjo when I was a teenager, so I mowed yards around my neighborhood to raise money, and I bought a banjo, one that I bought, which wasn't very good. And I said, maybe I can improve it. So I started trying to improve that one.
Today, George and Stanfield have a banjo-making workshop an hour's drive from Memphis, Tennessee. Visitors can tour their shop and see the hundreds of small parts that all come together to make the finished banjo. The two men make everything by hand. So it is not surprising that it takes around 4 to 6 months to make one banjo. The banjo has two distinct parts, the round part and the straight part.
There are two distinct parts. There's the round part and you have the straight part, and they're made separately.
The round part, the body of the banjo, is made of wood bent around a form to give the instrument its round shape. Stanfield explains that part of the process.
I will resaw it into smaller pieces like this. And I'll put it in a steam box, and the steam will make it very soft. And then I will put it in this form, and it will actually be able to bend without breaking. It'll bend around this.
After the banjo is finished, Tom George carefully wipes it clean. It is ready to be played. And then the team can do the other thing they love to do, play the banjo. I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. Last week on our program, we talked about the presidency of John Tyler. The future of Texas was a major issue in American politics in the early 1840s. Texas had declared its independence from Mexico in 1836. Now some Americans wanted the new Republic of Texas to become a U.S. state. But others wanted Texas to remain independent. The Republic of Texas permitted slavery. Americans who opposed Texas statehood wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler wanted to make Texas a state. Tyler was a Southerner. He supported slavery and wanted Texas to keep the system legal. The president also had political reasons for wanting Texas to join the Union. He wanted to show that he increased the size and power of the United States during his presidency. He hoped Texas statehood would win him a nomination for a second term as president. So Tyler asked his new Secretary of State, John C. Calhoun, to negotiate the annexation of Texas. On April 12, 1844, Calhoun and Texas officials agreed the territory would enter the Union. They said the new state of Texas could continue slavery. But Britain objected. A British official sent a note saying that Britain wished to end slavery wherever it existed, including Texas. Secretary Calhoun's reply to Britain went public. He defended slavery in the American South. He said what was called slavery was really a political institution necessary for the peace, safety, and economic strength of those states where it existed. Ending slavery in Texas, he said, would be a danger to the American South and to the Union itself. Many people in northern states rejected Calhoun's reasoning. They called on their senators to vote against accepting Texas. But President Tyler continued with his effort to take control of Texas. He sent Calhoun's agreement with Texas to the U.S. Senate for approval. Soon after, the Whig Party opened its national convention to nominate a candidate for president. As expected, the Whigs did not choose President Tyler. They nominated Senator Henry Clay instead. Clay had been working hard to win the nomination. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention a month later. Many Democrats wanted former President Martin Van Buren to be their candidate. But the convention took a surprising turn. The Democrats approved a rule that a candidate must receive at least two-thirds of the votes to win. In the first vote, Van Buren won the most support, but not two-thirds. The convention delegates voted again, and again Van Buren fell short. The delegates kept voting, but Van Buren never earned the number of votes he needed. In fact, Van Buren began to lose votes. Other candidates were suggested, but none of them seemed able to win the necessary two-thirds either. Finally, someone proposed a new name, James Knox Polk.
James Polk was a very fascinating man, very hardworking, relentless in his pursuit of goals. He was not a particularly likable human being. He was somewhat suspicious of other people, but he had a way of figuring out what he needed to do to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish, and he was very good at it, and that served him very well throughout his life.
Historian Robert Merry wrote a book about James K. Polk. Mr. Merry says Polk did not come to the 1844 convention expecting to be nominated for president. At the time, Polk's political career was struggling. He had already served as the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and the Governor of Tennessee. He was well-respected and serious. But Polk had lost in his attempts to seek re-election as governor not once, but twice. Polk came to the Democrats' convention hoping to re-enter national politics and perhaps win the nomination for vice president. When the convention delegates voted on their presidential candidate for the eighth time, Polk received only 44 votes. Then the delegates voted again. This time, Polk received all 266 votes. Historian Robert Merry says James K. Polk became the first real political dark horse in American history. In other words, he was someone no one thought would win. One reason he did was Texas. Polk wanted to make Texas a state. He thought the United States could take possession of the area peacefully. The other leading Democratic candidate, Martin Van Buren, did not think so. Neither did the Whig candidate, Henry Clay. Van Buren and Clay believed that annexation of Texas could lead to a war with Mexico, and they were afraid that if Texas were to become a state, Americans would clash again over the issue of slavery. So, Robert Merry says, both Martin Van Buren and Henry Clay spoke against bringing Texas into the Union.
And that was probably the right position from a standpoint of prudence, political prudence, or maybe diplomatic prudence. But it was the wrong position from the standpoint of where the American people were politically at that time.
In the 1840s, many Americans liked the idea of expanding the country. They believed in manifest destiny, the idea that God wanted America to expand west all the way to the Pacific Ocean and dominate the continent.
It's a very powerful concept, and it was not just a powerful concept, but it was a powerful impulse of America at that time.
As a result, Robert Merry says, many voters supported James K. Polk and his promise to add Texas to the United States. Polk took another unusual position in the 1844 election. He said if he won the presidency, he would serve only one term, that is, 4 years. Polk told voters he did not believe the federal government should have too much power. He said presidents and other elected officials might abuse their power if they held office too long. One term, he said, would be enough for him. But historian Robert Merry says there was more to Polk's one-term promise. After all, two presidents Polk admired, Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson, had each served two terms. The nation's first president, George Washington, had also served two terms. Robert Merry says Polk's one-term promise was also a political bet. Polk wanted other Democratic politicians to support him. Polk thought that if he said he would be president for only one term, other politicians might help him win. Then those politicians could try again to win the presidency in 4 years instead of waiting eight.
And I suspect that he was probably right. And given the closeness of the election, I suspect that had he not made that one-term promise, he very likely would have been beaten by Clay.
As it was, the election of 1844 was extremely close. Wild campaign charges were made against both candidates. The Whig candidate, Henry Clay, was called a gambler, a duelist, a man of dishonest deals. Stories were told about his use of strong language and love of card games. On the other side, Whig newspapers reported that someone saw a group of slaves being sold in Tennessee. Burned into the skin of each slave, the papers said, were the letters JKP, the initials of James K. Polk. In the autumn of 1844, 2,700,000 Americans elected a new president. Polk defeated Clay by only about 38,000 votes nationwide. But Polk won 170 electoral votes to Clay's 105. President Tyler believed Polk's victory showed the American people wanted Texas to become a state. When Congress met in December, he proposed that both the House of Representatives and the Senate resolve to give Texas statehood. In a few months, they did. President Tyler signed the resolution on March 1, 1845, just 3 days before he left office. The resolution invited Texas to join the Union as a state. It gave Texas the right to split into as many as four more states when its population was large enough. Texas could keep its public lands, but it had to pay its own debts. And Texas could enter the Union as a slave state. The Mexican minister to the U.S. objected to the resolution. Mexico did not recognize Texas as an independent territory. The minister said, making Texas an American state was an act of aggression against his country. He demanded his passport and returned to Mexico. Britain and France also sought to prevent Texas from becoming a state. They persuaded Mexico to agree to recognize Texas independence, but only if Texas would not join the United States. Texas thus had two choices. It could join the United States, or it could continue as a republic with its independence recognized by Mexico. The Texas Congress chose statehood. But the choice would come with a cost. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
That's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
This is